Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, Chair of the Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum, and your chairman for today. It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Daphne Miller, who will discuss her book, The Jungle Effect. Daphne Miller, MD, loves to cook, loves adventure, and loves her patients. Over the past 3 years, she has traveled around the world to find authentic indigenous recipes and traditions that can help preserve health and prevent the many modern diseases caused by a Western lifestyle. Dr. Miller graduated from Harvard Medical School in 1993 and then did a residency and research fellowship at the University of California, San Francisco. In 2006, she completed Andrew Weil's Integrative Medicine Fellowship at the University of Arizona. She spends part of her time teaching nutrition and integrative medicine nationally and internationally. She also has a private family practice in San Francisco where she frequently prescribes whole foods rather than drugs. Her two kids, ages 9 and 13, and her husband are happy to test any new recipes and often accompany her on nutrition adventures. Michael Pollan said this about the book. In this bracingly hopeful and eminently practical book, Daphne Miller shows us how we can bring the wisdom of traditional diets to our own plates in the interest of both our health and our pleasure. The Jungle Effect is a fascinating, useful, and important book, and is for sale in the back of the room. Daphne?
Thank you so much, Dr. Grant, for that introduction, and welcome, everybody. Thank you so much for coming. So, in the next hour, I plan to bring you on a world around-the-world adventure to healthy diets. But to start off with, I thought it would be helpful for me to tell you a little bit how I came to this work in the first place. After all, it isn't every day that you have a family doctor in front of you talking to you about whole foods. So imagine that you had just completed 7 years of a grueling training and were stepping out into the real world, into your practice, only to discover that you had been somewhat inadequately trained to do the job that you'd worked so hard to learn how to do. Well, that was precisely the position I found myself in when I finished my family medicine training. Sure, I was very adept at ordering tests and making diagnoses, even making exotic diagnoses, and certainly at prescribing drugs. But after several months out in the real world, I started to realize that there were many unintended consequences to these medications that I was prescribing daily with my prescription pad. And perhaps more vexing was the fact that I was not getting at the root cause of what was bothering or ailing so many of my patients, which was a poor diet. Now, this wasn't just my observation. There's an often quoted study, I'm sure many of you have heard it, that was entitled Actual Causes of Death. It was a very famous study that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association about 5 years ago. And this study estimated that about 80% of deaths from heart attacks, diabetes, stroke, were at their root cause due to diet, and to a lesser extent, lack of exercise and smoking, and that 40% of cancers as well could be traced back to this. So in my search to figure out how I could bring nutrition advice to my patients, I started first on a very conventional approach. I started going to conferences. I started consulting with nutrition experts. And yes, I started to buy the same diet books that many who are not in medicine buy, trying to figure out what was the key concepts in them, and specifically attracted to books that had been written by scientists, but many of the popular books that are out there. And what I found over and over again as I went through these books or went through these diets was that they made wonderful internal sense, meaning when I read the diet books with what I was learning about nutrition, it all made perfect sense. For example, high-fat, high-protein diets. Well, fat is very filling, so if you're on a high-fat diet, you're going to eat less overall. So that kind of, you know, an Atkins-type diet. And protein tends to be metabolized different than other types of nutrients and will actually put you into a ketotic state and make you urinate more, so you'll lose more water weight. So that made sense. Or high-fiber diets, another thing that was being touted. Well, fiber is incredibly filling, so that made sense. All of them were very logical. But what I would see is I would start my patients on these diets or would recommend them that they start these diets, and they would follow them for a while, see results, be incredibly enthusiastic, and eventually quit altogether, and either their health problems were yo-yo, their weight problems were yo-yo. And what I realized was that while these diets, as I said, had this perfect internal logic, they were lacking an external logic. They really made very little sense within the context of people's real lives. Like, where was the pleasure in the food? Where were the traditions? Where was the cooking? Where was the family time? All these things that food means to all of you. So this was starting to really trouble me as I was going on my search on how should I work with my patients around the topics of changing diet and changing food. And in the book, The Jungle Effect, I talk about a light bulb moment that happened to me with a patient who I call Angela. Of course, that's not her real name, but we're protecting anonymity here. And Angela came to me and told me that a very interesting story. She told me that all of her chronic health problems got better and her weight went down when she traveled back to her family's village in the rainforest off of the Amazon River in Brazil, and that she had stayed there for a while, and despite the fact that she was exercising less, she told me, and eating more, everything seemed to get better. And then she came back to San Francisco, and everything started to get bad again. And I, at first, really have to say that I discounted Angela's story until, guess who ended up not far from her village, working in a little remote clinic in the rainforest. It was actually in Peru, but right over the border from Brazil. Well, I did. I went down there for the summer. You know how freezing it can get here in San Francisco. And I went down there to volunteer in a tiny remote village. And while I was there, I observed two things while I was working in this little clinic. First of all, I noticed that even the most elderly patients who came in to see me, and there were a fair number of them, none of them were suffering from the diseases that really are my bread and butter in San Francisco. I didn't see any diabetes. I didn't see heart disease. I didn't see stroke. I didn't see depression, which is another disease that I clump in that bunch. I certainly saw snake bite, a little bit of malaria, a little bit of machete wounds. But none of the diseases that were really what I see day to day here. Secondly, what was more interesting to me was that there were tour guides who would bring foreigners in for a day to this remote village from Iquitos, was the nearby town, so that they could sort of experience this very remote rural life. And what I saw in these tour guides was that they, even though they grew up in the village, they were now living in Iquitos, and they looked completely different from their brothers and sisters who were living in the village. They could have been from a completely different part of the world. That while their brothers and sisters were lean and fit, they were sporting these jowls and pendulous bellies and were complaining. They would come into the clinic and complain to me about their modern ailments. And what was very obvious to me being there was certainly there was a lifestyle difference, perhaps more physical activity, but the biggest thing was the diet. What I was seeing was a diet that had evolved in one place over generations, and that made sense both in terms of the local foods, and that had been selected because not only because it tasted delicious, but because it actually kept people healthy. It kept them going generation to generation. And we talk so often of survival of the fittest when it, as it relates to humans, but this really was survival of the fittest diet. And it started me thinking about diets like this around the world that are still intact or relatively intact and that have a tremendous amount to teach us. And sent me really on a junket to different places around the world to discover these diets and bring the knowledge home. Well, I must confess to you that long before Angela and long before my trip to the Amazon, I really did have this romantic notion that traditional was better, as I guess probably many of you do too. It's just intuitively we think that way. But what had really happened to me while I was in Peru and then in my subsequent travels was that I was able to take my very standard nutrition training and match it up to much of what I was seeing in all of these places and realize that even though what I was seeing was culinary wisdom developed by people who certainly didn't know about omega-3 fats or vitamin A or diseases like pellagra, they had collectively as a culture developed foods that would pass the muster, that would pass the evaluation of even the most picky, stringent modern-day nutritionists. So what I'd like to do in the remainder of this talk, with your permission, is actually give you some taste tests around the world of some of these examples where culinary wisdom and modern science actually converge in a really fascinating way. And I'm going to start in the area that geographically is closest to us, which is Copper Canyon in Mexico. How many of you have been down into the canyons? Oh, wow, we have a couple adventuresome souls. You actually went deep into the canyons? Wonderful. Well, then you will know exactly what I'm talking about. Copper Canyon area in Mexico, which is in the state of Chihuahua, is about 400 miles as the crow flies south of Tucson, and yet incredibly remote area. And in Copper Canyon live the Tarahumara Indians, and they live in these little rancheros that are very remote, where you really do have to hike on these unbelievably treacherous trails to get to them. And it's a lifestyle that's a very conscious lifestyle. They really have maintained many of their customs and traditions and culinary traditions and have really not become a part of the rest of the fabric of Mexico. And what for me was so fascinating about the Tarahumara is that they are a tribe who are actually blood relatives to the Pima Indian of Arizona. And the Pima, I don't know if any of you are familiar with the Pima, but they unfortunately are famous for their high rates of diabetes. By the time you are an adult living in the Pima tribe now in 2009, you have about a 30 to 40% chance of developing diabetes. And if you are a Tarahumaran living deep in the canyons, it's much closer to less than 3 to 5% chance. So we know that it's not genetics that's making the difference here. And I was really fascinated to see what could be. Now, this, and I don't know if this is, can you all see this picture here? This is a traditional Tarahumaran household. And what you see here is they are cliff dwellers, and it's very remote, as I said. And I was not welcomed in with open arms, and as I shouldn't be, because I was a perfect stranger venturing down there for a relatively short period of time. So I must confess that this photo was actually taken with a telephoto lens and me creeping around the corner of a trail. But what do you see growing in front of their house is a giant cactus bush. Now, this has wonderful kind of architectural use because it is there to protect the dwelling. It probably provides them with some shade in the heat of the sun. But from a nutritional standpoint, for them, it is a wonderful source of their daily greenery. It's really the way it would be as if you had a mesclun salad, a little crop of mesclun salad growing outside your door here in San Francisco. And it's used every day in cooking. Now, it turns out that the nopales, or the cactus, the pad, is a wonderful source of fiber. It also has vitamin C. It has many other nutrients in it. But it also has a substance which is very much insulin-like in its nature. So here are the Tarahumara living with a giant pharmacy right outside their front door, and specifically a pharmacy filled with a medication that lowers blood sugar. Researchers have gone down to this area of Mexico, and there's a wonderful article that's published in the Journal of Ethnobotany talking about over 300 plants that grow in this region that lower blood sugar. I mean, some of them that you might be familiar with are cilantro, jicama, and so on. But nopales are probably the king of all of them and are the one that is so frequently used in the diet. And you can buy them right here in the mission, and you can even buy them prepared if you're too lazy or too scared, as I was, to take the prickly pears off yourself. Now, this is the backbone of the Tarahumaran diet. The tres hermanas, or the three sisters, which are squash and corn and beans. None of these look quite like the ones that we get here. They're all very, you know, wild and sort of free range. But the thing that strikes me immediately is that when we talk about anti-diabetes diets or lowering your blood sugar, what is the first thing that nutritionists tend to advise people? Is to cut out the carbs, right? But here they are eating carbohydrates and having hardly any diabetes. But the one thing that we often don't say to people is cut out the refined carbs and don't worry so much about things that really you're eating in very much the same form as they come from the earth. So they're eating a lot of the squash and beans and corn in a very unprocessed form. And it's the corn specifically that I wanted to talk to you about, because here is another example of wisdom and science converging in a really interesting way. Here on the left, the corn kernels are being treated to nixtamal, which means to put the corn in a lime calc solution. And this is a process that has been done, probably you could trace it back to the Aztecs. It's a tradition that's been used in Mesoamerica for hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of years. And yes, there's a very practical reason, just like there's a practical reason for growing the nopales in front of the house, there's a practical reason to soak the corn. What it does is it softens the outer coating and makes it so you can easily remove it so that you can grind it on your metate on the right and make your tortillas. But it turns out that soaking the corn in that calc solution imbues the corn with amazing qualities. It then becomes calcium rich. Calcium is very important in controlling blood sugar. Niacin rich. Niacin raises your good cholesterol, your HDL, and lowers your LDL. And we know now that lipids are very important, especially in people with prediabetes or diabetes, but in anybody who you're trying to control their risk of diabetes. So all these benefits that come with doing this process were the Aztecs sitting there and thinking about niacin and calcium, I doubt it. But they were eating this, and it was keeping them healthy and making them feel better, and so it's a tradition that continued on generation to generation. Now, here's the third piece of culinary magic that I wanted to show you with the Tarahumara. These are some traditional tortillas that have been made with the nixtamal, with the masa corn that was made from those grains of corn. Now, it turns out that if you were to sit down and chow down on those tortillas, your blood sugar would actually have a pretty quick spike, because corn is relatively more quick release into your system than the beans and the squash. But this is where food combining comes in. You never eat the tortillas alone. You always eat them with the beans and the squash. And it turns out that the glycemic index, the rate at which that sugar from the corn is released into your bloodstream, slows down to match that of the beans when you eat them together. So food combining at its best, and this is part of the traditional diet. Let's move on to another country, and I'll show you some other stuff that was really interesting for me. This is Crete, and, you know, just about every 6 months, there's a major medical journal that reports on the latest study that the Mediterranean diet prevents blank. The most recent one was Mediterranean diet lowers risk of Alzheimer's. But, you know, we've seen it for heart disease, we've seen it for stroke, and so on. And I love it when they report these studies, because you could almost take that word Mediterranean diet and replace it with, like, Prozac, you know, prostate medicine. I mean, it's really, they use the term Mediterranean diet as if it were a pill. And yet, when you start to think about it, what does Mediterranean diet really mean? Well, you read the fine print on these studies, and it's not like they took a bunch of volunteers and stuck them in a room like lab rats and fed them a Mediterranean diet. These are people who are living in France sometimes, in Greece sometimes, in Italy sometimes, and who are more adherent to their traditional diet. And yes, the researchers have found a score, a way of marking them as more adherent, but they're living within their culture. They're not having that diet with a capital D. They're having diet as it relates to their whole lifestyle. And so I decided I was going to travel to the place that is sort of the mecca for Mediterranean diet, the mother of all Mediterranean diets, and that is Crete. And I'll tell you why. It really has to do with a physicist named Ancel Keys. And he actually worked for the U.S. military and did a bunch of experiments before he did this one. But he loved the Mediterranean. I guess he got to travel there a little bit with the U.S. military. And what he noticed was that men in Europe in general, and this was in the 60s, or actually the late 50s, were looking a lot healthier in their 50s than men in the United States, and specifically in his hometown in Minnesota. And so he asked himself, how is it possible for middle-aged men to not die of heart disease? And he designed a study, and it was the seven-country study. And what he did was he looked at six countries in Europe and compared them to his hometown. And he was looking at who were the group of men who lived the longest. And it turns out that it was the men in Greece, and specifically the men on Crete. And he looked for general mortality, but also for death from heart disease. So I thought I would go to Crete to find out why. And this right here really holds the answer to the question. These are called meze. And anybody who sat down for a traditional meal on Crete or anywhere in Greece will tell you that this is not a feast. This is an everyday meal. This could even be your lunchtime break from work. You just sit down to lots of little plates of food, and you share it with a lot of people, so it makes sense to prepare a bunch. And you eat bits and pieces together. You sip your wine. You have a great conversation. You might need a nap before you go back to work, for sure. But this is really was actually my lunch the first day that I was on Crete. Now, you look closer there, and yes, it's delicious food, and I can tell you some reasons why just the design of this meal is going to make you eat less. There's some research now showing that when you taste more complex foods and a greater diversity of foods, you actually eat less quantity overall. Isn't that interesting? And when you sit down with a group of people and have your meal be something that's social and sharing, you also tend to eat less overall. Maybe that's because you're not watching TV and doing this, but, you know, it tends to correlate. But then you get down into the specifics of the meal, and I'll just give you a couple of examples. Look at that slice of lemon, and look at that what that plate is, which is wild greens. How many of you are told if you're going to take iron to take it with something acidic? Have you seen your doctor and said, because it's better absorbed? Well, apparently people on Crete don't need to go to their doctor to be told this. When they eat their wild greens, they eat it with things that are acidic so that they can absorb the nutrients. And then above that, you have a Cretan rusk, that bread, and then you have the feta cheese on top of it. Now, it turns out that grains are actually filled with phytate, which is an anti-nutrient, which will keep you from absorbing the magnesium and calcium in the grains, all things that are very, very good for your heart. But if you serve that grain with something fermented, or something acidic as well, but something fermented like the feta, it actually breaks down that phytate and makes the nutrients more readily available. So there's another interesting interaction. And then we have things that are swimming in olive oil. And you might say, oh boy, that's a lot of oil, olive oil. But specifically foods like tomatoes, which are filled with a number of different antioxidants that are good for you. But tomatoes need to be cooked in an oily solution in order to release those and in order for it to be absorbed. So the oil actually acts as a vehicle for delivering the antioxidants into your system. So those are just some examples there. And needless to say, there's hundreds, if not thousands of them in that dish of food. So one of the secrets to the Greek diet is that they're really, it's the recipes. It's not that there is one specific food. It really is the interaction of all these foods, and not just the recipes, but how they're eaten in the day and how they're served and so on. This is Stelios, who ran one of the first organic food stores in Hanya, and I just wanted to show you some of his fabulous grains there. And this is me orta picking with Katerina, who ran a little taverna. Here we are with our bags of wild greens, and that really is what they do there. They go up into the mountains and pick the wild greens. I called it the dirty fingernail sign because you have to use a little knife and then you use your fingernail to pull the green out. And when we went back to the taverna, I proudly handed my bag of greens to Irina, who's Katerina's grandmother-in-law. And she took one look inside my bag and she threw it to the chickens when I wasn't looking. So obviously I didn't quite know how to pick the right ones yet. But and here's the fish, which another incredibly nutritious part of the diet from Crete, filled with omega-3 fats. This is octopus, which is a wonderful source of it. But I wanted to talk to you about the olive oil specifically, because everybody always asks about the olive oil. Actually, it's always everybody's first guess about what the magical ingredient is on Crete. And I say, well, it isn't the only thing, but it certainly is the backbone to the food there. And there's really four reasons why. First of all, as I said, it helps you so that you can absorb the other nutrients. It makes other nutrients much more bioavailable. Many things that need to be soluble in a fat in order to get absorbed, and if you cook them in the olive oil. Secondly, they themselves are filled with wonderful, wonderful antioxidants. And how many of you have tasted fresh-pressed virgin olive oil? You have. Well, the way you can actually test it is that it should give you, if it's a good quality one, is that it should give you a zing in the back of your tongue. People are nodding there in the audience. And that that zing is really telling you that it's got its healing power. Thirdly, it probably replaces less healthy fat. So if you're cooking with olive oil, you're not cooking with loads and loads of an oil with trans fats or an oil like corn oil, which has a lot more inflammatory omega-6 fats in it. So probably healthy for that reason. But if you ask people on Crete, what is the true healing power of olive oil? And I think that probably any nutritionist would agree with this. They say it makes you eat healthy foods that you would otherwise not eat. And I totally agree with that. I mean, picture that plate of wild greens, if that had been boiled in water, let's say, and just served to you on a plate, you'd probably be like, ah. But it comes swimming in this delicious golden olive oil with a little bit of garlic on top and so on and so forth. Garlic, which also is wonderful for the heart. And you're much more likely to dig in. So we were talking about actual ingredients and food combinations and recipes and how they have so much wisdom associated with them and yet hold up to modern-day nutrition vetting. Here is an example. This is Yorgos, who ran the Bioleia Olive Press in Crete, and I put his picture in because I loved his grindstones there. He actually sells to Whole Foods now. But this is Nektarios, and what Nektarios is showing me is what his favorite meal is during Greek Orthodox fasts. I happened to be on Crete in March, and it was at the end of Lent, and people who are observing the Greek Orthodox rituals on Crete actually spend over 100 days a year in some kind of modified fast, be it from Christmas or Lent, or there's about 15 days around the Assumption as well. And during that time, the reason I say modified fast is because they're still eating, and they're actually eating wonderfully. That meal I showed you was a modified fast meal. But what they're giving up is red meat and excess liquor, and that's, I guess, for each person to interpret on his own, and desserts and refined grains. Those are the things that they give up during these 100 or so days a year. Now, researchers in Greece have studied folks who adhere to these fasts, and they found that during the fasts, their cholesterol levels go down, and their BMI, their body mass, goes down. Now, the interesting thing is people who observe these fasts intermittently year-round maintain these even on the non-fasting times, even in the times when they're bringing stuff back into their diet. So for me, this is and this is a wonderful lesson in how moderation can be something that, you know, is good to maintain perhaps at all times, but even if you bring it in for clumps of the year, it's getting you a lot further than someone who is not doing it at any times at all. And here is an example of a religious ritual, but where the clinical effects, the health effects are really quite obvious. So I am going to bring you now to West Africa. I hope you don't, I'm not giving you making you dizzy here with this very rapid world travel. But I wanted to bring you to West Africa, and specifically to a country, Cameroon, where I worked for a while. And one of the fascinating things for me in Cameroon while I was there was learning how incredibly low their rates were for colon cancer. And not just colon cancer, but all diseases of the colon, like diverticulitis and diverticulosis and Crohn's disease, and hemorrhoids, which are, believe it or not, associated with other colon problems. And what for me was so fascinating is that in the United States, we have very high rates of colon cancer. And as a subgroup, African Americans tend to have some of the highest. And yet they have relatives in West Africa who have some of the lowest. And they certainly can trace, many African Americans can trace their ancestry to there. And so it isn't necessarily genetics that we're talking about. There is some difference in diet, much as we see with the Tarahumara, and actually much as we see with Greek Americans when they come to the U.S. So with every culture, what is it about our culture? So we'll get to that at the end. But I was really fascinated about this huge difference in the rates of colon cancer on the order of many, many, many per thousand. So really quite dramatic. And in Cameroon, I think it can all be summarized in one dish. And this dish is really just, I know it looks like a pile of slop on the plate, but it is the most delicious thing I have ever tasted. And I have the recipe in my book. It's kind of the light version of it, but it's called ndole. And I'm going to tell you what's in it, and it's going to be hard to believe that it all works together, but it's got some kind of ground nut, like peanuts. It's got falon, which is wild greens, which could, you know, you could use collard greens or dandelion greens. It's got shrimp or some kind of fish. It's got red meat in it. It's got ginger. It's got turmeric. It's usually served over either fermented millet or fermented manioc root. And I'm probably, and it's got palm fruit oil. And it's delicious. It's absolutely delicious. So let me talk to you about ndole, because within ndole, I believe, and the research supports, is much of the answer to the difference in colon cancer rates that we see in the two regions. So this is meat in Cameroon. This meat represents a dowry or a wedding gift, a wedding celebration, or a funeral, or some other very, very important event. It is not to be sacrificed at whim. It's not to be killed at whim. So as a result, when meat is used, it is used incredibly sparingly. Okay? So flesh in moderation, and I've got my F's here. Secondly, the folon, the wild greens, are filled with fiber, and they're also filled with folate, which, at least in a test tube, seems to block the reproduction of cancer cells, and specifically colon cancer cells. It has healthy fats, and palm fruit oil actually has beta-cystosterol in it, which is shown once again to block replication of cancer cells. It's that rich red oil, not to be confused with palm kernel oil. The fermented food, which is the fermented manioc or the fermented grain that it sits on top of, is filled with healthy bacteria, which help the gut to regenerate itself. And there's now a lot of research exploding on the relationship between fermented foods and probiotics and lower cancer rates. So very fascinating. And then this is not an F, but spices that are in this dish as well seem, like turmeric and ginger and so on, seem to lower production or reproduction of cancer cells. So here is this dish that has all these anti-cancer foods in it and really is a giant pharmacopoeia, again, for preventing colon cancer. So last but not least, I want to take you to Okinawa. And the reason that I went to Okinawa was actually to teach in the medical school at Chubu Medical School on Okinawa, which is it's a joint program through the University of Hawaii and Japan's medical training system. And it was a very fascinating experience for me. But while I was there, one of the strange things that I found myself doing was lecturing the medical students about nutrition. And here I would put up these pictures and tell them about the local diet and how good it was for them as they sat there and sipped their Coca-Colas and ate their Big Macs, because the younger generation, and they would look at me with these big eyes like, really? But one of the things that's so fascinating on Okinawa, they have incredible longevity in general, but what for me really caught my eye was the incredibly low rates of breast cancer and prostate cancer. And especially because when Japanese Americans emigrate to the United States, their rates of breast and prostate cancer match those of everybody else within one generation. So once again, we know it's not genetics that are playing the major role here. So the foods were so informative. Green tea has ECGC in it, which is an anti-cancer forming agent, and specifically been studied for breast cancer or mammary cells. And there is now a couple studies funded for prostate cancer. The genmai, which is the brown rice that's traditionally eaten, it's not what people are eating now, the younger generation. They're eating the white rice, like the stuff that we get in sushi restaurants here. But traditionally, the brown rice is filled with trisin, which has also been shown to prevent reproduction of breast cancer cells. And here is the ultimate balancing act in foods. On the left, you have purple yams, which are just a favorite within the Japanese diet. And on the right, you have different kinds of condiments made with seaweed. Now, it turns out that seaweed, with its iodine, is very stimulatory to glands, specifically to the thyroid glands, but glands in general, versus on the left, the purple yams and also the soy in their diet is very inhibitory to these glands. And so what you have, what they call, is the perfect yin-yang, you know, this balance of these two kinds of foods within the diet that keep things from either, you know, from overgrowing or undergrowing. And I love this example. One of the things that really perplexed me in Japan was their infatuation with pig. And the Makishi Public Market here had row upon row of pig. But if you delve deeper into it, first of all, you find out that they're using small amounts of pig, and it's generally free-range pig that's eaten that same purple yam. And pig is actually a great source, especially when you're eating the offal from the pig, which is more of the innards and so on. It's a great source of vitamin A and vitamin D, something that we get very rarely in our diets. Once again, it seems to have very potent cancer inhibitory roles. Now, the other thing about this pig is it's filled with proline and elastin, a collagen forming, so it helps with regeneration of tissues, and it must play a role as well. But as I said, there they eat the whole pig. Now, in each place, I try and tell you a little bit about the culture. And in Japan, and specifically in Okinawa, there's a saying, hara hachibu, or eat until you are eight parts full. I don't think I need any more of a diet plan than that. It's perfect. I know it doesn't sell books. But if you keep that idea in mind, to not eat until you're absolutely busting filled to the gut, but find that part that's eight parts full, what wisdom right there. And certainly something that any nutritionist would endorse. So in summary here, we have fresh and local produce, meat in balance, and also the whole animal, non-meaty proteins, and we talked about the yams, and I didn't show you much with nuts and so on, but soy, certainly, indigenous oils, fermented foods, spices, and the eating traditions, and these are the things that I find all over the globe. I do want to end with one thought before I, and then I'm going to just open it up to questions, and that is that I am certainly not the first nutrition explorer to do this kind of work. As a matter of fact, a very famous one who preceded me by about 80 years was Dr. Weston Price. I don't know if any of you have heard of him in this room. He was a dentist, and he believed that dental decay was sort of the dental equivalent of heart disease. And he actually traveled to a village not far from the one I was in Peru, and observed that cultures that were eating traditionally and eating, you know, making a lot of the same observations that I did, were living long and healthy versus at this point 80 years ago, he was already seeing deterioration within Western culture. What I think, and there's been quite a few nutrition explorers that have followed Dr. Price, what I think distinguishes me, sadly, is that I might be one of the last of these types of explorers. And that's because these traditions are swiftly vanishing. When you hike to the furthest corner of the rainforest in Cameroon and you're handed a Coca-Cola by a Babinga pygmy tribesman, you know that things are not going well. And everywhere that I traveled, I saw examples of this. This is Okinawa, you know, land of the long-lived people. And, you know, we've had U.S. military presence there for, I guess, about 60 years now. And as a result, there's a McDonald's on every corner and higher per capita consumption of McDonald's there than even in the U.S. And the younger generation is dying of heart disease and stroke in higher rates than we are here. This is a back of a cereal box that's sold in Japan. And basically what it says in Japanese is, don't eat that thing on the right, which is the traditional breakfast they've eaten for generations. I mean, should be brown rice, but otherwise fish, seaweed, and so on. Eat this thing on the left because it has more fiber and is better for your heart. Never mind the omega-3s and the fish and all the antioxidants in the seaweed and so on. This is a billboard that you find all over West Africa. This one I took in Ghana. And it's saying, you know, there's this nice neat fufu, which is the traditional yam that you can make, once again, rich in nutrients. But take this pulverized insta fufu instead, which is a staple in their diet. But the fufu that they're selling has no nutrition. And this is a little, this is the Medina and Fez and trying to, you know, you can't even get a car up the streets there, but they've managed to find a way how to get the precious eau de Coca-Cola up the street. And finally, this is the back of a store in Creel on the top of Copper Canyon. And they're telling the Tarahumarans, don't bother to make your tortillas with the hand grind in these tamales. You can buy this maseca, you know, made in a big factory actually in Los Angeles. And you know, it's going to be a lot better for you. So I saw examples of this all over the world. Here I am in Okinawa working with this group of young doctors who are part of the metabolic syndrome team. They talk about this like it's some new exotic disease. Metabolic syndrome is basically a combination of diabetes and heart disease, but it's exploding there, and they needed a team of young doctors to be trained in how to deal with this. And so that was part of the reason that I was brought there, was to work with these doctors. And you can see I'm in the nutrition ward there, and what am I holding? a can of spam. I don't know what it was doing in there. But I don't want to end on a totally depressing note. I feel that if we have been able to export our manufactured foods around the world, we certainly can begin to export a renewed value for tradition and culture. The food movement in the United States is starting to embrace that, and we're taking a lot of traditional seeds and growing them and replanting them. And a lot of farmers who've come from other cultures, if you go to the farmer's market, like down in Alemany Farmer's Market, you're starting to see things that are, you know, that were grown on Okinawa that are now being produced here. So we have this renewed love of tradition, and I think that it actually is something that now we're going to have to send back to the places that have lost it. So just to end one little story, here I am trudging around the highlands of Lasiti in Crete, trying to find the secrets to the diet on Crete, apparently looking quite exhausted. And this woman comes up to me on her mule, and she stops, and there's really no tourists that time of year. It's March, really cold out. She asks me what I'm doing, and I tell her I'm looking for the secrets to the diet of Crete. And she says, oh, her name was Evgenia, let me tell you. And she starts to tell me recipes and family traditions and so on and so forth. And then all of a sudden, she looks at me and she said, gee, you look terrible. Come on, get on. And so here I am being led back to my hotel, a woman in her young, early 40s by a woman in her late 80s. And I'm sitting there on top of her mule thinking, boy, I really want to get to know these traditional diets because I think they have a lot to offer me. So thank you so much. And I invite your questions now.
Thank you, Daphne, for your colorful, nutritious, healthy, and tasty world culinary tour. Thank you very much. Now we're open for questions. I've got the microphone.
Hi, I wanted to ask you, I had just recently seen a study by in Taiwan. It was of children who had leukemia. Some had them, some didn't, and there was a Harvard doctor involved too. And apparently the study has said that there's a 74% higher chance of getting leukemia, for children to get leukemia, if they eat hot dogs, sausage, smoked meats, salami, and that kind of stuff. Have you heard anything about that?
I don't know specifically for leukemia, although I can't speak to that number. I do know that in Japan, we were seeing an explosion in both stomach and esophageal cancer, and that was thought to be related specifically to the preservatives that are now being used in a lot of the modern non-traditional foods, for sure.
Dr. Miller, what is your opinion about a vegan diet?
You know, I don't have opinions about diets. I know that's really strange for a doctor to say that. I think that there's many, many ways to eat healthy. And I think that you can be an intelligent, engaged, cognizant vegan, and I think you can also be an irresponsible vegan and have, you know, B12 deficiency and so on. I think what's most important is to eat in a way that resonates with you and that is authentic for you and isn't using a lot of foods that are drowning out your taste buds, the sort of highly palatable foods that we're exposed to so much in our culture from places like Chevy's and McDonald's.
Yeah, I recently read about the oldest man in the world, lives back east. He's 113 years old, and he credits it to his diet. And he eats four fruits a day. He eats a big breakfast, and he skips dinner and drinks a lot of water. And also Jack Lane, he just turned 95, who's extremely healthy. He also eats four fruits a day, and he eats a salad for lunch, and he has five egg whites for breakfast, and he loves wild salmon. Could you comment about their diets and why they're so healthy?
Well, I think that when you get into extreme longevity, I mean, I have a patient who's 103 and eats terribly and says it's all due to having a great sex life. So, you know, and there's a woman who died recently in Mississippi, I think, at 115, and she ate ice cream and fried chicken her whole life. So I think when you get into extreme longevity, what we're really talking about is someone who's been dished out an incredibly fortunate set of genes, and really jealous of them. But What I do believe is, A, that when you eat well, you feel better. And I see that over and over again. And that's different than eating obsessively. I see a lot of people who are totally orthorexic, completely preoccupied with their diet, and are miserable. But when you eat well, you feel better. And plus, on an observational level and in terms of larger studies, when you eat well, you are healthier overall. So you're much more likely to make it from 50 to 80, let's say. But I'm not guaranteeing that eating well is going to get you to 115. So does that answer your question?
Yeah. First of all, that was a great lecture. Thank you very much. And it's amazing what you've done and accomplished with all your travels. I lived in Switzerland for 25 years, and I was fine. And I came here 5 years ago, and I'm 35 pounds more than I used to be. And I have two teenagers that constantly are throwing donuts on the soccer field, and I'm very frustrated, and I can't go back to Switzerland right now. My kids love it here. Do you see any hope?
Yeah, I first of all, thank you for sharing that. And I know that's a very brave thing to share. And I have many, many people who come up to me after my talks and tell me their version of your story. And one thing, and I didn't really tell you the epilogue to Angela, because what I did was I actually prescribed her recipes. I brought recipes back when I came back from Peru, and it was really for her this incredible moment where she realized that she wasn't being given a set of rules, but was actually given foods that were joyful and that resonated with her. One of the big challenges to staying healthy in our culture, unfortunately, is that you have to be able to take the time to feed yourself. There are not very many places that you can go, including the self-serve bar at Whole Foods, and find foods that are really going to be authentically healthy. And sadly, many of the indigenous traditional restaurants that exist in our community are not real as well. I mean, I saw huge packages of Skippy peanut butter in the back of a Thai restaurant when I was working on this project, and, you know, my heart dropped. And my brother lives in Thailand, and I know they don't use Skippy peanut butter there. So, you know, part of it really is starting to find that time. And with teenagers, it's so hard. I have two teenagers, too, so I know what it's like. And, you know, trying to get engaged in the kitchen and trying to get the family engaged in the kitchen. Interesting study showing that if you can eat at least 2/3 of your meals at home and start to have that be the backbone, you know, then you're going to just by definition be healthier. You know, as long as those meals aren't just opening a can or, a frozen box. But even starting there and starting with baby steps makes such a huge difference. And then, of course, getting out and moving your body is part of the equation as well. And that's always very challenging.
I have a question. For maybe 17 years, I had a vegetarian restaurant. Then I had a natural foods bakery and a cafe, and I do all my own cooking. I try not to eat processed food. So, and I had given up coffee many, many years ago and started drinking green tea. And then I read that coffee is supposed to prevent Alzheimer's. So I started drinking, you know, really just 6 ounces of making really strong coffee in the morning mm-hmm. with French press. And it's like I'm jittery all the time. And I'm wondering, do I have to go through this to prevent Alzheimer's? I mean, I like the taste.
It's, you know what? Doing the New York Times crossword puzzle also helps prevent Alzheimer's. It probably has the same benefit as coffee. So maybe you can do, are you doing coffee and the New York Times crossword puzzle? No, I'm sorry. I'm giving you silly answers here. But I find that we think too hard as food as medicine, and I'm feeding it to you here by showing you these wonderful convergences between tradition And yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. But there are many, as a matter of fact, a lot of the anti-inflammatory spices like turmeric and ginger and so on have also been shown to have a role in preventing Alzheimer's. And a diet high in vitamin D has been shown to prevent, or, you know, potentially prevent Alzheimer's. So, and the Mediterranean diet has been shown to prevent Alzheimer's. So there, I would not put too much on one specific food. I know that people sell books about superfoods, and I know that if I were to endorse a superfood, I could probably, you know, retire from my medical practice. But that really isn't the key to either culinary pleasure or to health in doing that. So if coffee doesn't work for you, don't drink it.
Yeah, this long-lived guy also said he only takes one baby aspirin a day and no medicines from the doctors.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering, what do you feel about vitamins? As you get older, you don't digest the
food.
That's
a wonderful question.
And
yeah.
Do you recommend anyone take any vitamins
Thank
along
you.
With your food?
Thank you for asking that. That's a great question. Most of for people who are eating mindfully and getting fresh and local foods, many of which we're so fortunate to have access to here in the Bay Area, stuff that still has the dew from the morning dew and the dirt from the field on it. We are actually getting a lot of nutrients from our food. If you're eating free-range meat in moderation or no meat at all and using other healthy proteins, you're probably doing very, very well. I tell people there's no harm in taking a multivitamin each day. Probably 80% of it's coming out in your urine. But, you know, there might be 20% that's sticking magically somewhere. Now, I do see patients who are ill and have vitamin deficiency states or have illnesses that are associated with vitamin deficiency states. And I do put them on, and then I do use vitamins as medicine. But I feel like that should be more within the purview of medicine or nutrition or and so on. And I feel that in general, we self-prescribe way too many supplements with absolutely no data to support it, other than that it's making nutraceutical companies very, very wealthy.
I enjoyed very much listening to your talk. Yes. I spent some time in Egypt and had mesa plates every day, never thinking why there was the acetic and the olive oil with the greens and all that. And I felt great eating all that. I saw someone on TV interviewed this week, and he has also written a book about different places with longevity. And, you know, he talked about, like you did, with Okinawa and Italy and Costa Rica. But one of the
You sure it wasn't me with a beard?
Yeah.
No? Okay.
You're better looking than he was. But one of the places he mentioned was Loma Linda, California.
Uh-huh. Oh, was this the Blue Zone?
Yes.
Okay.
Blue Zone.
At least a few. There's not like five of us out
no.
there. I don't know.
And he mentioned about walnuts soaked in water.
Uh-huh.
And the reason that they are so healthy is all their food they eat from the Bible.
Uh-huh. Yeah, oh, so sprouting the walnuts. Yeah, it's the same concept probably in what I was talking about with the grains and the fermented or the feta. Or you could also take your grains and soak them overnight, and that's a way of eliminating the anti-nutrients. And actually raw, I don't know how many of you get a reaction on the top of your mouth to walnuts, but raw walnuts are actually slightly toxic. And so it's really good to either toast them or cook them or soak them before eating them.
There has been a lot of research talking about caloric restriction. And, you know, there has been so many studies replicated by university after university with monkeys and with rats showing that, you know, the rats or the monkeys that eat the least were the ones that actually survived and lived the longest. You know, rarely do you see somebody that is in their 90s or, you know, even later than that, that is obese. My grandmother is 97 years old and she's like a skeleton, mm-hmm. you know. She eats rarely. You know, goes back to what that gentleman was saying about the individual that eats, I don't know, two or three fruits a day. There has also been a lot of, I just want you to comment on these things.
Sure.
There also has been a lot of research talking about medium chain triglycerides in the production of ketone bodies. There's hundreds of papers talking about how children that actually have epilepsy, you know, just by having a ketogenic diet and restricting the amount of carbohydrates that they take, they're able to control the levels of epilepsy by 60 or 70%. And there's a huge link between attention deficit disorder, autism, you know, all these diseases that affect the brain have sort of an underlying mechanism. I was just wondering if someone has this, you know, restrictive diet where is more prone to producing ketone bodies and focuses on medium-chain triglycerides, if they have a better chance of avoiding these neurodegenerative conditions in the future.
Let me speak. Thank you for those questions. And I think to not go down the path of tons of biochemistry here, let me speak specifically to a calorie restriction, because that's a very dire sounding term, calorie restriction. And in truth, what it really, when you look at what is the health benefit of it, it is the hara hachibu. It is what the Japanese practice, which is really 20% less. And that's the number that scientists come up with when they talk about calorie restriction. Now, it's calorie restriction compared to what our standard American calorie intake is, which on average is really too high. So it's not calling on people to starve themselves. And I think that term is a terrible term, calorie restriction. Really what it should be more is just sort of reasonable calorie intake. And being more mindful, not eating to total fullness. And that in and of itself has been associated with longevity and health. In terms of actually being in a ketotic state or being in a slightly starvational state, I cannot speak to that, and I don't know what the studies are. But I can tell you observationally that traveling around Crete, and actually if you even look at Evgenia, who's in her early 90s, granted she wasn't 115 yet, but she looks like she's got at least another 15 years of mileage on her. A lot of these folks are not anorexic looking. A lot of them have a little padding on their bodies. They're not overweight, but they have a little bit of padding. And I think we have one concept in our culture of how you're supposed to grow old, that you need to be really scrawny and skinny. And, you know, there is data that you have a little padding on you. It certainly is going to help you fat cells help produce hormones. Maybe those hormones, are, especially for women, might be beneficial in terms of bone health and heart health and so on. So, you know, I would not make hard and fast rules about a physical appearance that you need to have in order to grow old. I think it's much more important that you eat well and exercise. Thank you so much.
One final question. I noticed that the diseases you studied, diabetes, heart disease, colon cancer, breast and prostate cancer, are all vitamin D sensitive diseases. And people in the countries you went to were either sunny countries or people probably spent a lot of time outdoors, like in Okinawa. Have you looked at the role of vitamin D in those countries?
Certainly, absolutely we know that here in the States, low vitamin D levels are associated with all of these. And the one place I didn't talk about was Iceland, where I went to, because they have very low rates of depression. And there was some hypothesis about vitamin D playing a role there as well, believe it or not, because they actually get so much sun in summer and they eat a lot of organ meats and get this huge boost of vitamin D in the fall. But in terms of actually looking at data on vitamin D and diet and change, I have not, and I think you probably would be a lot more prepared to speak to that than I am, seeing as that you are the vitamin D expert.
Okay, we'll talk about it offline. Okay, our thanks to Dr. Daphne Miller for her comments here today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 106th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.